Ready to dive in? Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast. Every episode, we explore, expand, and evolve our understanding of the truths we encounter and experience in our human quest for clarity and exponential growth. And now welcome your hosts, Dr. Jeffrey Smith and Jim Case. Welcome to Adventures in Truth Podcast.
Dr. Jeff here with Jim Case in Adventures in Truth Podcast. Good afternoon, everyone. How are
you
today,
Jim? Everybody. Hey, Jeff. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am well. It's another Friday, and still looking at life sunny side up, as they say.
Right on.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a snowstorm, but it's still sunny side up.
That's just hard for me to imagine. As beautiful as it's been here, and the flowers and the butterflies and everything, hasn't moved that far east yet, I guess, huh?
Spring. Nope, it's coming. I mean, yeah, we had the last 3 days, it's been 60, 70 degrees and just stunning. The last 3 days, 4 days. Yeah, 4 days or so. So it's been good. People out in shorts and t-shirts and, you know, getting out and about. I think this is just last throes of winter stuff. They say it happens into April. And so it's not supposed to be huge, maybe an inch or two, but supposed to snow all night.
Huh. How about that?
Pretty cool.
Well, today, you and I had a chance to chat just before we hit the record button. Wanted to do a dive into the truth about struggle, the truth about challenge, the truth about acceptance. And cool. Let's see what we can do to push into those topics and see what nuggets we can come up with.
Right on.
As a reference, as a starting point, as some context or some background, for folks that have not ever watched a video called Mouse Utopia, a lot of where some of the concepts and principles that we'll be talking about today stem from this 20-year study that was done actually a bunch of decades ago. When you watch the video, it's a lot of black and white stuff. So in the 50s, 60s, presented to Congress and the National Institute of Health. Back in the 70s, the reason that it's relevant to me today is because it's really hard to not see a direct correlation between what the outcome of these studies with the rodents were and how our society is unfolding and manifesting its behaviors today. So,
is this any way related to Who Moved My Cheese?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, you're familiar with Who Moved My Cheese? That
I am. Yep.
Especially because we're talking about rodents again.
Yeah. There may be some correlation, but off the top of my head, I don't know that that had a lot to do with struggle and challenge. But anyway, I suppose we could, in a roundabout way, tie those together if it all comes up.
No. It wasn't going there. Just didn't know if there was a relationship, if there was a connection to the two.
Uh huh. So before we really pull apart the summaries or the learning points from the Mouse Utopia 20-year-long experiments, we could take a look at some of the principles or philosophies of different world religions or different sacred manuscripts that talk about struggle and talk about challenge. In all the synonyms or homonyms that go along with those two words. And in past podcasts, we've talked about a parable called A Man Finds a Horse. And we've talked about how judgment goes along with pieces of information. And just as kind of a refresher, I won't do a perfect job of recalling the parable, but the parable goes something like one day a man is out and about and he finds a horse and he's telling somebody that's close to him about his experience. And that person says, "Oh, that's fantastic." And the next day, while the man's riding the horse, he falls off the horse and breaks his arm. And the man says, oh, that's bad. That's awful. And the following day, some people from the government come by and they recruit all the young men in the village to go fight a war, except for him, because he broke his arm. And the person says, oh, that's great. And the thing keeps going back and forth of what is good, what is not good, what's good, what's not good. In the end, the man finds his wife as a result of the horse. He has kids. I don't know if he lives happily ever after or not. Not necessarily the point. But it's just interesting that throughout our lives, this happens, we say it's good. That happens, we say it's bad or difficult or hard or whatever. And we're constantly judging things. Mm-hmm. I believe in the Buddhist thinking, teachings, they say that struggle is necessary. Struggle is inevitable. And I've always had a hard time with that. It seemed to be as like you're being complacent or giving in to the inevitability of struggle, which I think I am evolving to where I'm now seeing it as necessary and maybe just have a little bit better understanding of the purpose or how that facilitates our growth and the lessons that we're learning. In a previous podcast, I remember we talked about how a chicken, as it's pecking its way out of its shell, in doing so creates an appetite. And once it gets out of the shell, it turns back to the shell and it eats the lining of the shell, the membrane that separated itself from the shell. If you ever eat a hard-boiled egg, you peel the shell. There's a small, very thin membrane that separates the hard-boiled egg from, and so that's what, in an uncooked environment, the baby chick eats. And in doing so, not only is it its first meal, and it doesn't have to look far to find it, it's also full of antioxidants and antibiotics. And unless, this is the important part, unless the chick eats it, if the chick does not eat that, it will perish. So if you help a chick out of its egg because you feel sorry for it, oh, here, let me help you. You look like you're struggling so much. Let me help you pry apart this egg and help you out. It won't have the appetite and it won't eat the membrane and it will die. So that's where we get the term or the idea concept that sometimes help isn't helpful. That's a really good example of that.
Yeah.
And then as an observer, sometimes it's hard to watch people struggle. It's hard to watch. And you just want to help. You want to reach in and pull things apart. When we were talking about the egg example and the chicken before, I also remember talking about how the same is true for a butterfly. When it is emerging from its chrysalis in its struggle to get itself out, it pumps blood into its wings, and then it's able to fly at some point after it dries off. So again, if you help a butterfly out of its cocoon or its chrysalis, it won't fly. And then one would feel really bad about, oh, I helped you out. But then, you know, a bird swooped down and ate you because you were sticking on the stick and didn't fly away.
You know, what's so interesting to me about those analogies is that they so powerfully illustrate some of the biggest challenges in the metaphysical community, in the healing community itself, because the foundation seems to be predicated on people need help, and predicated on the idea that their conflict or their suffering or their challenges need to be remedied. And I've talked a lot about this when I was doing groups at my center. We talked about this a lot because healers would come in and talk about how all they could see were broken people, and all they could see were the people who were not well and needed to be fixed, and the world needs to be healed, and this person needed to be healed, and that person, you know, and all of this assessment and judgment of the state of their state. And the thing that was always powerful to me about that and still is if that's how you see the world, you are not and should not be a healer. Because each of us really has no ability to impact anyone else's experience unless that person has called for that interaction. And even then, they've called for it not knowing what the answer is. And then when they get it, they may not want it anyway. So, I mean, that's a whole other story. But the idea of the healer has to see wholeness. You know, there was the, we've talked about this once before, I think. There was the, they talk about Jesus. And not to get, not necessarily by getting religious about the healer aspect. And that the reason Jesus was able to do what he was able to do was because his ability to see through all of that nonsense to their wholeness is what created the space for their healing. And his ability to hold that space for them temporarily is what brought them to healing. And it was their inability to maintain that state once they were in it that caused them to go back to what they had dealt with before. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I love the analogies of it because it's something that I struggle with personally. Not whether I'm looking at broken or unbroken, but dealing with people who only see broken or talk in that fashion. And I'm like, yeah, no, you're of no value. If all you can see is the brokenness, you can't achieve anything with this person because you can't see bigger than they can see right now. And that's what they need. They need a bigger space. And that's what you as a healer should be able to accomplish is creating the bigger space for them to see, oh, a bigger space exists. I can walk into that. So anyway, carry on. Sorry, that was just, I just really love those analogies you were using because it so speaks to so much going on in the world right now.
I agree. Yeah. So as you were chatting, I was thinking of putting the things you were saying and I was sharing into some context about one of the main purposes of us being here on the planet is to do this thing that we call learning. And then as a result of what we're learning, we would, through our example, do some teaching. And that could really summarize the whole experience of being here is what are we learning and what are we teaching? And
can we talk about that word a second?
Which one?
The learning. I don't know if we had this conversation before. Wondering if you would entertain experiencing as opposed to learning.
Yeah, I see them as the same.
Yeah. And they're wholeheartedly not. I would say that learning is a subset of experiencing. It is not experiencing in parallel. Because experiencing incorporates all aspects of the being, where learning is mental. Learning is using the mind. Learning is learning steps. It's how do I do A, B, C, D. Experiencing allows for what you're talking about with regard to challenges, with regard to healing, with regard to all of the things that you opened the show with. Those come through experience because we create in our lives experiences in order to more deeply understand how what's going on mentally and emotionally and spiritually. And so I just tend to gravitate personally toward experiencing rather than learning because I think learning is a little limited personally.
Okay. Food for thought. Through my experiences, I create a database, and from those experiences, then either choose to not re-experience those experiences or modify them or in some way move forward. So to me, it still comes down to data from what you've experienced as to what you're going to do with that moving forward or not, or just continue to cycle many lifetimes in the same experiences.
Yes. What have you learned from the experience? That order makes sense to me because like you said, you have the experiences, then you extrapolate from those experiences. And sometimes that learning is going to be emotional. Sometimes it's going to be spiritual. Always it's going to include some component of all of it. I can't think of anything that I've ever learned that that wasn't visceral, that wasn't whole, the whole, you know, when it was a aha, it wasn't a limited aha, it was an aha that connected dots in on all different levels, you know. So there's okay, so we're talking in the same direction.
Yes, sir.
As usual.
So, yeah. So if we're here to learn through our experiences, of which apparently need analog sensing sensors, otherwise you could watch this. So the learning that we're doing requires bodies that have ears and senses and energy perceptions and all of, six or seven or 20 senses that we have, who knows? Struggle is a part of this. And here's where, this is where there's the shift that I've been able to make in the last couple of years, that I can now embrace the struggle. A couple of years ago, I had a pretty major incident that involved a whole bunch of surgeries to repair, and 30 days in the hospital and 2 years of physical therapy twice a week afterwards. And I'm still not finished with that, but getting darn close. And I learned about pain. I learned a lot about physical pain. I learned a lot about shifting priorities in life and slowing down and that sort of thing. That was quite a struggle. And I can absolutely look the camera dead in the lens and say, I'm glad that that happened, and I wouldn't undo it. People could say, you know, if I could go back in time and change that, I would. I wouldn't. I'm absolutely flabbergasted and glad that all of that happened exactly the way that it happened, because I can see the positive learning that took place that for me needed to be at that level to get my attention in order to make those changes that I have made. And right now they feel like they're permanent changes. They're solid, which feels good. And again, the struggle was necessary. The challenge was necessary. And it taught me about me. It taught me about a whole lot about me and how I can then parlay and share that with other people to embrace their challenges that they're going through. Again, at a high level, and we're talking about over $1 million of medical bills. That should get people's attention. And we're talking about 14 surgeries in a 24-month period of time. And we're talking about deeply, deeply, deeply wounded body parts down to the bone level, ligaments, tendons, all that good stuff, nerves, both arms. Even skin graft from another part of the body. So lots of senses popping off all over the place of, ouch, this hurts. And when is it going to stop? When's it going to go away? Can I do this? Do I want to do this? Even having to deal with at one point a possible amputation and contemplating how life would change in some regard, if that was a reality. Where I want to get back to as far as the Mouse Utopia experiment, without stealing the thunder, and I really do hope that this conversation will lead to a bunch of people going to YouTube and looking that up and watching. There's a 24-minute version and a 45-minute version, both very well done summaries of I apologize to the doctor who's probably dead now that did the study. But very famous, well-known studies regarding behavior in a utopian environment. So let's camp on that for a second, this idea of a utopian environment.
And I'll make sure to find a link, and I can include that link in our description with the doctor's name too. So if people are interested afterwards or during the podcast, they can always go click that link and learn more about it.
Yeah. And while I'm thinking about it, because if you just Google Mouse Utopia, or not Google, but if you search Mouse Utopia on YouTube, you'll get a whole bunch of hits. The one in particular that I can remember had a subtitle of like Down the Rabbit Hole. And I think that might be a weekly YouTube show or something the guy does that's called Down the Rabbit Hole. And it was the topic of Mouse Utopia. That's one that I watched that's, I think, the 24-minute version.
Okay.
But anyway, this covers a period of time of 20 years. Several well-known, respected researchers created ideal conditions for mice to live in that were free from predators, number one. Number two, had adequate space and had unlimited resources for water and food. And they were also well-bred mice that could endure captivity, that were bred for captivity. Had long-term genetics to allow them to thrive in a captive environment. So all the conditions were right to do the study. And it was repeated with modifications over and over and over and over again for 20 years as they continued to modify the environments as far as the spaces and where the nestings were and bridges and feeding containers, and all these things were tweaked to make it more and more and more conducive to what we would call a utopian environment. And I'd like to pause on that note for a moment and talk a little bit about utopian environments and what I find a lot in our practice and even in other discussions that we've had on our podcast about some kind of a maybe subconscious, unconscious notion of us living in a utopian environment. That there, to me, seems to be a program that many people have that we believe we would desire to live in a world free from war with adequate resources, enough for everybody, sustainable, all in harmony, kumbaya, let's hug and watch butterflies fly around. I hear that a lot. And we even have a saying for that, or this idea that we want to experience heaven on earth. It's even in the Lord's Prayer, as earth in or in heaven, as it, on earth as it is in heaven. You know, there's this concept that's very old of wanting to have an existence here that's more peaceable, more free from conflict, strife, enemies, that sort of thing. So do you see that too, Jim, as a kind of just a generic desire that a lot of people have or that they would try to create if they could?
I do. Although I think I want to clarify a little bit with regard to there's part of its terminology, part of it is clarity of a sort. And that is the utopian, wanting to create a utopian world does not, to me, preclude the fact that we are going to be individually challenged regardless. And I say that because it's something that it was funny when you brought this topic up, because it's such a powerful thing. I was talking to my ex, my mentor, who she is 21 years my senior. And so that makes her 75 now. And she throws papers because it's something she can do. You know, she's up in the middle of the night. She goes out and throws papers and has been doing it for quite a few years. But she had an accident a few weeks back and fell and busted a few ribs. And so I've called her twice in the last 2 weeks or so, or 3 weeks. Actually, probably over the last 4 or 5 months, as I've talked to her, virtually every time I talk to her, something has happened. Something in the way of, you know, she had pneumonia, she broke some ribs, she was in a car accident, she messed up her arm. And part of my call to her on a couple of those occasions were because I was wanting to share with her what was going on with me. And I was feeling really conflicted, feeling really strung out, feeling kind of like, you know, what am I doing? Where am I going? And she's been my mentor for a long time and helps me to kind of clear the clutter, you know, so I can kind of get refocused. But the thing that struck me is so powerful, and I said this to her twice in the last three conversations, this has really been a powerful exercise in perspective, because I'm calling and then I get to hear all of the stuff that you're going through, physical, yucky, unpleasant stuff. And I'm calling with my spiritual dilemmas, which to me are pretty powerful. But in context, that's like perspective. I'm not suffering. I'm going through stuff. I'm walking my path. It's causing confusion. It's got the rub. It's what I like to call contrast, as opposed to struggle, or contrast or challenge. But it isn't. I'm not suffering. If I'm suffering, it's because I'm choosing to suffer. If I'm suffering, it's because I'm choosing to be on the negative end of the spectrum, and I'm choosing to indulge that experience. It doesn't mean that I'm not challenged or hurting. It doesn't mean that I'm not a lot of things. But for me, suffering has a particular connotation that is a little different than I think most probably look at it. But the thing that strikes me is that two times I said out loud in the conversation, at the end of the conversation, wow, this has been a powerful exercise in perspective for me. Because compared to you, I got nothing wrong in my life. You know, and I don't mean that, I didn't say that to her, and I don't mean it in any kind of condescending fashion. But the things that I'm bringing to the table are not inhibiting me from exercising my daily life. They could be a little confusing and they can be a little frustrating, but in the end, I still get to decide whether I'm going to focus on bringing joy to my life or I'm going to be miserable. Those are still a choice in the context of having those energies rubbing on each other. So the delineation to me is that there is a difference between when people are talking about utopia, there's a difference. The idea that in utopia, then we don't have these external problems of war and strife and famine and homelessness and whatever else is eliminated. But those things at the same time, I think, are things that are catalysts. They're results, but they're also catalysts, because all of these individuals that are focused there are dealing with their own struggle internally about the external issue. So war didn't happen because it's just a random occurrence in the universe. War happened because enough people thought their way was the right way and came together in a fashion in consciousness and then went after each other to prove who was righter. And that's what it is, but that's the outward creation of the inward problem. So creating the utopia on the outside is nice, but it's not going to resolve what's happening on the interior unless people learn how to begin to navigate their interior and be willing to realize that, as you were saying from the beginning, that the contrast or the challenges that we encounter are absolutely necessary to help us clarify what we want and what we don't want. They help us clarify who we are in our own process in the world, right? So of course you want to have challenge, and you're going to have it regardless. And the point of me bringing all this together was, I'm having challenges and there's nothing wrong with my life. I'm challenged by my perceptions. I'm challenged by what I see happening in the world, and how can I impact it or not impact it? Or am I not even supposed to pay attention to it? You know, I'm conflicted by these things. And it doesn't change that my focus is on creating joy in my life and to create joy in as much of the world as I can. But there's a process we all are here for, you know, that experiencing thing and that learning from experiences thing that takes us to the next place, that takes us to greater understanding, that takes us to a bigger, broader, more powerful connection to all the people in this world that we're around. And then back what we were talking about before, where you shift from that perspective of it's a broken world to it's a perfect world to it's a whole world. And how can I help impact that? not how do I get rid of the conflict? Because that'll go on forever. And if you try to focus, if you focus on the conflict, you're creating more conflict just by virtue of focusing there, because that's where your consciousness is. It's in conflict. So how do you shift that? Well, then you have to change the focus to something else and recognize that the conflict you're experiencing is a part of your destination. So
good points.
Long answer to your question, but that's my
question. Good point. Love it. So let's put another question out there to the audience as they're listening to me slowly reveal the study and the outcomes of the utopian mouse experience. So the question is, what do we think happened? What do we think we learned? What do we think was observed? So again, these were large, say like bedroom sized environments for the mice to live in. And they did this, they knew enough about mice that you need X number square inches of space per mouse for it to feel okay, for it to breed, for it to feel that it can segregate during breeding and the mom can protect the baby mice and all that sort of thing. So all that was known and done in advance, and it was tweaked many times along the way. So what happened was they start out with two males, two females, again, highly bred for these experiments. And then over X number of days, they knew the population would grow to a certain size. And then they believed that it would peak out once the certain ratio was achieved of X number of square inches of space per mouse, that the environment would dictate where that would level off. Before that actually happened, there was a territorial, issues that occurred, and the alpha males identified themselves. I don't remember exactly what the numbers were, but within the first year, the population peaked, started to roll over and decrease. The establishment of territories and the numbers of female mice to the male alphas hit something like a 70%. It's like 70% of the mice were being in a harem style arrangement of like two or three of the maybe 1,000 mice that were in the container. About three males had like 70% of the females, which was an interesting fact. This is kind of an interesting piece here where I'm moving into now. Once the males that didn't have females to breed with experienced that for a while, they started breeding with each other. And they began to engage in interesting behaviors like chewing their ears off, like biting their tails off. And some of the what were called beta males allowed themselves to be bred as in having babies, but they were having sexual engagements with the alpha males, which that was something that was not anticipated in the study as to the sexual behaviors that occurred once a peak population had been achieved in an environment where, again, there's no predators, there's no mice that were being chased by birds or cats or anything else. Mm-hmm. And they have ample supply to unlimited water and food. Within 2 years, the colony died. That was the biggest eye-opener, that over and over and over and over again, the entire colony died. Mm-hmm. Even the alphas that had all of the females, they just stopped breeding. They reached a point at which there's no challenge, there's nothing going on here, I'm bored. No purpose to just, they just stopped eating and they died. And this happened on a cycle of about 2 years over and over and over and over again in all of the studies that they did. Yeah, that is a big Well, so how they are
in that,
go ahead.
The thought that was going through my head as you were saying that was, oh, okay. The Egyptians, the Atlanteans, the Lemurians,
right?
The Aztecs,
right?
The Incas.
We'll get to the Americans.
Well, we're not
get to the American.
We haven't completely killed ourselves yet, but yeah. No, I was thinking in terms of those civilizations that have literally gone by the wayside in their entirety, without any, you know, I mean, other than some, you know, buildings or some rocks or some artifacts, but literally there are no, that we know of, people of those people still on the planet. Maybe there's blood somewhere, but yeah, they don't exist.
And are you also saying that the, what we don't know, but we've seen in movies and some of the literature, maybe the Egyptians, for example, did they create a utopian environment? Did they get really close to achieving, we just don't have much struggle. So therefore we're engaging in very interesting sexual behaviors. And at some point there just isn't much to do here. So we get overtaken by the Carpathians or whoever.
Yeah. I forgot the Romans too. The Romans were especially engaged in the aberrant activity, mm-hmm. As time went on.
And aberrant would be defined because that was normal behavior for them, but it was aberrant for a society that's engaged in, we got to go find food. We got to build houses. We have all these challenges.
Yeah.
So that isn't that interesting that we arrived here at a culture that has need to go out and struggle to find, to chase, to build versus a society that all that's taken care of.
Yeah.
With regard to how that shows up.
Aberrant, choosing the word aberrant also clearly demonstrates the judgment that exists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether that's a religious overlay, whether that's a cultural overlay, whether that's a white people overlay, I'm not sure where that was going to come from. But interestingly enough, I was observing, you picked that word up immediately and went to shift the focus and energy of that word. And when you did it, it struck me and I went, wow, that fast. That clearly went from observation to judgment.
Well, let's camp on this for a second, because what's popping in my head is you named off all of these ancient civilizations. If we just came a little bit more current and we went to, say, Pilgrim, whatever we would call the Pilgrim mindset, Plymouth Rock and Jamestown, Yorktown, all those sorts of things. You know, I'm thinking of very modest, very private presentations of sensuality and sexuality. And so much of that was, are we going to make it here or are we going to die? You know, are we going to figure out how to build structures that we can live in? And are we going to build, you know, figure out how to farm and, you know, or are we going to die?
Yeah.
I don't know much about those same people from where they came, but I would venture to say that where they came from, Spain, England, different places, that there were probably brothels, there were probably different ways of expressing sensuality and sexuality that were more libidinous, more open, more expressing. And again, probably because everything was already established. They had enough security. They had enough closer to utopia, perhaps, if we're still trying to use that word or that idea, that aberrant could really be more along the lines of plenty versus scarcity as far as how our sensuality and sexuality shows up, of which this was not supposed to be part of this podcast, but here we are. It happened.
Well, and I find it interesting that you went to the puritanical roots, because what's interesting to me about that as you were talking was the reality that at first I was confused, because I'm like, no, we're white people. We're not dead yet. That was the origins of the white people. I don't even know that they were necessarily white. I think they were brown, but that's beside the point. Some of them had to be white. They were
pilgrims.
Pilgrims.
Right.
But the thing that's interesting about that is still the core of the one. It's the core of the religions that are promoted in this country. And it's still the core of what most people have been entrained into since birth. And it's been repeated over and over and over. It's expanded some, it's extrapolated some, it's maybe not as closely puritanical because the number of religions expanded and those religions got looser about some of that puritanical stuff. So as you picked your religion based on what was your comfort level with how puritanical this was. You know, if you knew you were going to like be out and about, you weren't going to choose to be a Puritan, you were going to choose to be a Presbyterian because they're a little more liberal. They're a little more, you know, I'm not making that up, but I'm the point being that the choices then began to expand, but at its source, they are the source of what we are now. And a lot of what we are trying to reconfigure in the human experience, because it's we've seen how much detriment that has created to all people, whether you believe or don't believe, because there's persecution and there's, you know, there's my way and your way. There's Presbyterian versus Catholic. There's Catholic versus Jew. There's all of these conflicts built in. So anyway, I'm not sure where I'm ultimately winding up with that other than to say how powerful it is, because it's only migrated through our experience to the present day. And
right.
You can still find it everywhere.
Right. Well, where I think we landed, at least from me following along and jumping here, there are populations living today in America very much like the ones that landed on Plymouth Rock. They're the Mennonites and the Quakers.
Yep.
And I don't know much about them, but again, they really practice modesty. Who knows what only lurks inside their minds that we don't know about. But if you, because they're living today, 2019, just like we are, if you compared the sexual behaviors and practices of the Quakers to, say, a similar group of people living in San Francisco, I just pick San Francisco, very liberal, open,
right,
expressive communities, the people that are living off the land, that go out and gather the eggs, that even challenge themselves to not use modern electricity, are probably that puritanical, very structured, limited sexual expression, versus people in San Francisco that wouldn't know the difference between a chicken and a crow. And I'm not, I hope that didn't sound derogatory, but I just mean, you know, it's been a while since they've been to the chicken house to pick up a chicken egg live on the farm. And it's probably been even longer that they went to the well to draw a glass of water. They don't think about things like that. So the utopian environment that urban modern living provides allows us to completely forego many, many challenges. Many, many challenges and struggles are just completely bypassed by living in urban environment. Anyway,
you're talking about that's more struggle with survival as opposed to, that's core stuff. But I don't necessarily think that the Quakers or the Mennonites actually are operating from a place of purely from survival. But
well, it's like it's not survival so much, Jim, as they intentionally create struggle for themselves more so than the urban environment. They don't have electricity, for heaven's sake. You know, they have to light a candle. They don't have electric motors, and they want to drill. They don't have an electric drill. Right, they don't have a manual drill.
They don't have the same conveniences. But wouldn't you say that calling that is actually a judgment of their...
No, I'm trying not to judge, just observing it as they somehow, maybe it's a wisdom that they have of have enough struggle in your life, enough challenge in your life to not make life so easy and comfortable that you kind of just walk a straighter line. And I'm not trying to judge a curvy line versus a straight line. If it came out that way, I'm not trying to judge that at all. It's just an observation.
Yeah. No, that's good. The as you were talking, I was thinking again about this idea of, so as I understand energy and things that the way things evolve, it starts on the inside and goes to the outside. So while the outside can act as triggers, it's still an internal process. It's still, those things are still starting on the inside and migrating to the outside so that we can put it in front of us and see it. You know, a lot of times those, the things that we have issues with or the areas that we're struggling with, it takes getting it created into the environment so that we can see how it actually works or see how it actually comes together or see what the result is, in order to inform our experience once again, so that we can take that piece and then move on to the next piece. So I don't want to get too far afield of the personal responsibility piece in lieu of the idea of utopia outside of self versus utopia inside of self, which are very powerful concepts, but just that we also make sure to not leave it all on the outside. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. So where I took the Mouse Utopia documentary and what was presented to Congress was the observation of our own societies, the welfare system, for example, our Indian reservations, another example, our prison system, another example, where they're all undesirable conditions. They're you don't want to be on an Indian reservation, in a prison, or on the welfare system. You just don't want to be. But these are three places. Even some of the military, you could say, where you create an environment where you've got a place to sleep, as much food as you need. You don't have to worry about your clothes or anything. We watch some very aberrant behaviors show up in those environments. For example, the Morongo Indian Reservation that's halfway between Los Angeles and Palm Springs. The last time I heard, as a member of the Indian reservation or the nation, each member gets $10,000 a month from the income from their casino for just simply living on the reservation and being a member. Mm-hmm. And they have the highest rates of drug addiction, alcoholism, teenage pregnancy, violent crime. They don't hold a job. They're not doing anything with their lives. They have vehicles that are broke down in their driveways and they won't go out and fix them because they just don't do anything. And please, if you have Indian heritage, I am not trying to offend anybody right now. It's really more of a travesty or a crime, I think, that we've discovered that's happened, that there right now isn't an immediate solution for.
No. I actually have direct experience with that as well. My ex-stepdaughter was married to a Hopi, and that's very much exactly how it worked. Their child is a Hopi Indian, and she receives benefits, and it was a big deal for a long time because her mom is a white woman, her dad is Native, and there was some conflict there for a bit. I mean, the point being that I can verify and back up your story that happens, and those things that you talked about happened, and again, it has nothing to do with in any way bashing. It's more of just recognizing the within the context of this conversation about creating utopia and about creating this magical thing that the human condition doesn't support it.
Right. I've seen in my practice the most broken, wandering, purposeless group of people that I work with are trust fund kids. They may be adults now, but because they don't have to work, even though they've been to college, but it probably took them twice as long to get through college, and they changed majors several times and even locations of going to college several times. Yeah. And they've held jobs, but they don't hold on to them. They've been in relationships, but they don't last. And they know that they don't need to. So it's almost like, you know, there are some obviously that can be successful with just put the monies there. And if I need it, great. But otherwise I got to roll up my sleeves just like everybody else and find someone to serve, something to support, some way to exert myself. Mm-hmm. And if I don't, I'm going to put a needle in my arm. I'm going to blow powder up my nose, put a bottle in my hand, sit in front of the tube and do nothing and waste my life away and be miserable.
And I think that's one of the things that's so awesome about this environment is there are so many unique and there's 7.5 billion unique and interesting paths that are being exercised. And, you know, if you take this back to some of the other podcasts we've done and conversations about our evolution into being a human being, you know, the what happens before we get here stuff, you know, the laying out the map and setting up the environment and choosing the players and all of that stuff that so clearly speaks to this idea of it doesn't matter what you do or where you are, you will have within the context of your choices, you're going to be challenged by the environment you chose because that's why you chose it. And it's a tough nut to swallow because we want to think based on the utopian idea that if life was better on the outside, life would be better on the inside. If there wasn't these things going on, but if you, as you were discussing the reservation and some of the things that occur in different, you know, even with the Quakers or the Mennonites, they all still have the come to Jesus moments, even if they're not talking about Jesus. They're all having their own personal evolution through that environment, and mm-hmm. their choices are what creates what they see, not the fact that, you know, oh, I'm getting this lump sum of money. Cool. Now I can do nothing except that's not what we're here for. I mean, it could be because if you find joy in that and you can walk that in a way that fulfills you and satisfies you, then heck, what the heck? But if that involves abuse, if it involves addiction, if it involves, you know, any kind of addiction, you've made a different decision because the world that you see is not the world you're that conflict for you or that challenge for you I don't know if the word is clear enough, because if you think about like the choices with drug addiction or alcoholism, regardless of race, regardless of people, is the result of being unwilling to deal with the challenge of your life as it is. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So the challenge of your life as it is too much or isn't utopian enough or isn't perfect enough or isn't right enough or isn't whatever it is and isn't enough. When again, it still comes back to how you feel about you. The judgment comes because I'm not good enough to meet the challenge that my life presents, the challenge that I created in my life to move me forward, to help me become more of who I am. I'm not up to that challenge. And because I'm not up to that challenge, I've now judged myself as unworthy and less than. And because I've judged myself to that extreme, the challenge feels so big. The judgment is bigger than the challenge, and the judgment now becomes the addiction, because the addiction is the result of that self-judgment that says, I'm not good enough. I need to medicate. I need to do something to change how this feels.
Right.
And it just becomes this, you know, becomes this wheel. And at the point, and it's so interesting if you look at it from the perspective, from the reverse perspective, from the recovery side, it isn't until they come back to taking responsibility for the condition of their life, for the challenge of their life, that they find their path to healing. When they come full circle again, you're going to start exactly where you left off. When you got off the train didn't go anywhere. You got off the train. The train's still sitting there waiting for you to get on it. So you got off that train, got on a different train or a bus or a motorcycle or a car or a bicycle, or you walked and you wandered around for as long as you did that until you came back and went, oh, I guess I got to get on the train to get where I'm going. And the one that I took isn't getting me where I'm going. And that in of itself extraordinary in the challenge. But that's where I would differentiate between the challenge, which is the acknowledgement of what that life experience process is, and the suffering, which is when you got off the train and decided to take a different mode of transportation that didn't serve your life purpose or didn't serve your life unfoldment. Now you're in suffering. That's suffering to me. When you come back and you get back on the train that you were on and you take responsibility, there is no more suffering. There's challenge for sure. There's all kinds of things, but again, it's when you veer off that clarity that you find struggle, because the struggle is in the fight between the judgment you have of yourself and the choices you've made as a result of that judgment.
Right, right. I like the way that you have delineated those two words. That's nice.
Cool.
That's clean. That's nicely clean. Well, as you were talking about challenge, there's a phenomenon in professional sports regarding the difficulty of repeating a championship.
Mm.
It's very rare for a baseball team to be back-to-back World Series winners, or a football team to be back-to-back Super Bowl winners. And the understanding behind that in sports psychology is, once you have achieved the pinnacle, you've already experienced that I'm standing on top of the mountain. And standing there again is not nearly as rewarding regarding the effort required to stay there as it was the challenge to get there.
Yeah, because it's not a new mountain. It's the same mountain. Except, that's interesting. That creates a really interesting thing in the head there. So mm-hmm. thinking about, I mean, the obvious example is New England.
Yes, yeah.
Here's this team. They've had personnel changes, but the two key consciousness holders of that organization are Bill Belichick and what's his name? That's horrible.
Brady,
the quarterback.
Yeah.
So they maintain an extraordinarily clear and powerful focus. Because there's no way they could get there again without it, because everything around them is changing. So they have to get everyone into alignment with that vision and then keep them there for that entire, whatever it is, 6 or 8 months.
Right. So they've been on that mountain longer than any other team. Like if you got the cellar dwellers yeah. that are the one or two games a year, but I don't know how many years in a row New England has won the Super Bowl. I don't know if they have been back-to-back champions. They'll win it, then they'll go there the next year and lose it. Then they'll go there the following year and win it again. So
that's
I don't
true.
Know.
I think that's true. I'm gonna double check the math on that. I gotta.
Yeah. But it's interesting that sports psychologists know that a champion has to find another level, another reason to continue to put forth the Olympic attitude, the Olympian mindset to get there and stay there. Pretty interesting.
It is. It was reminding me of, I was thinking of Michael Phelps and how interesting, because he has 4 years between experiences to go back up on that mountain. So,
right.
But interesting enough, and I was thinking about this as we were talking about New England, is the mountain actually, it could be that the reason that they are able to achieve it again and again and again is because they don't see it as the same mountain. If they continued to look
could
at
be,
it as
yeah.
the same mountain, you couldn't get there from here for the exact reasoning you were providing, which is, there's no challenge. What's the deal? You've been there. You saw it. It's, do you really want to put the work in to go there again? Now, some may say absolutely hell yeah, but we're humans. We don't maintain our focus that long for that long a period of time. It has to be re-engaged and reinvigorated and re-stimulated and re-excited. And maybe it's that whole idea of, it looks like it's the same mountain, but it's actually not at all the same mountain, because it's not the same personnel. The teams they're playing are not the same personnel, the same coaches. They don't play in the same places. There's a lot of moving
yeah.
parts. But anyway, I got distracted there. Yeah, that's cool. That's a powerful way to, especially in a group dynamic, because it's not only about the individuals, but it's also about the group consciousness.
Well, I know it's my brother's a head football coach, and he's won his conference championship like 10 years in a row. They haven't won their national championship in the last 10 years, but they all have conferences and divisions and that sort of thing.
Right.
And what he's constantly reminding the players of is someone else wants to take this from us. You know, we can be here. You can rest on your laurels, or you can operate in the knowledge that if you really want this to be your number 11, you got to know somebody else also wants it. Because it's like he can't show them anything they don't already have, because they already have it. So he just has to remind them that there's someone else working as hard or harder to also get it. And sometimes the fear, if you will, of losing what you have creates that challenge. But anyway, we've been having some fun talking about challenge and struggle in our life. And I was sharing with our audience earlier that it's meant a lot to me to embrace it.
Yeah.
As it, by embracing it, I do not mean inviting it.
It'll come. You don't have to worry about it.
Yes, exactly. I'm not asking for any more of it than I'm ready for and have aligned myself with embracing and have the ability to stand up and deal with it. And doggone it, it's good stuff, man. It so lets me know who I am.
Yeah.
I was having a discussion not long ago with a person who is not so keen on going flying with me, even though I have many, many years of experience flying. And I was referencing, and like the last 5 or 6 flights, there's been some aircraft malfunctions that have occurred that have made the flights very challenging. A couple of times flying at nighttime, the headlight went out or the landing light went out. And that's not something as a pilot you can control. They're like light bulbs and they occasionally don't work.
Yeah.
And I had 2 that didn't. And we had an alternator that went out once over Palm Springs. We ended up having to land with absolutely no radio communication, no lights, no ability to communicate with the tower. And all those procedures, they're all emergency procedures. And my son and I engaged them, and we did a great job. And we had a couple of passengers in the back seat. And I remember after we landed, I apologized to them that happened. You know, that wasn't part of the agenda for that day. And I remember the husband of the couple that was with us said, "Are you kidding me? That made it so much more exciting." And he goes, "I never doubted for a minute that we were in danger, but who gets to say that we got to fly into Carlsbad in a completely blacked out plane and be able to land with no lights? I mean, who gets to say that they did that?" I just chuckled. But those are the things that, now, as a pilot, I get to add that to my list of, I know what to do if that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so where a lot of people would say, "Oh, I would never want to have to be in that situation," I'm like, well, if that happens again, I've been on that mountain and it was fine. It was okay. And so I got to know a little bit more about who I am as a result of taking on that challenge. And it's fine. It's good. It's good stuff. And I welcome the next one.
I think what the thing that I want to drive home for the listeners about something that I think is very important to understand in context to this conversation is how you perceive or what you perceive is your destination. And what I mean by that is what you were describing, you know, with the plane and the things that I've been encountering as we're building this website, similar challenges, but the end game, the end result is what changes the tone of that experience. And what I mean by that is that you have your destination being your evolution, being your expansion, being your growth, that, you know, it isn't just, I mean, yeah, you can say it's just a nice meme, But there's, you know, the idea that everything is really colluding for your benefit. Everything is forward moving in some fashion. The question is, can you be there with that in that fashion? And that's the important part, I think, that I want to really relay to the listeners, is understanding that it's your internal, that thing we've talked about a lot, the core vibration idea, mm-hmm. the idea of understanding what the foundation, you may not know all of the ins and outs of your self-understanding. There may be a lot of stuff in the way of all that. And we all have it. It isn't that, you know, Jeff has less and I have more, or I have less and Jeff has more, or anything like that with any other human mm-hmm. being. It is our chosen set of circumstances that we chose specifically to support us in that growth and evolution. So if you remember the destination and you can stay clearly in that, then as Jeff was talking about the plane, as you could see in his expression and as he was talking about it, there was lightness, there was joy, there was enthusiasm about this experience. And was it overwhelming in the moment? Probably. Was it a lot? Probably. Did it feel really challenging? Hell yeah. But the difference being, was it challenging? Hell yeah. Not, oh shit.
Right.
Two different responses coming from two different places. It isn't to say that we don't all have an immediate response, because we've been trained that way for a long time to go the oh shit response. But all it takes is a minute to, not even a minute, 2 seconds to go, I can do something different here. I don't have to say oh shit. I can go, holy cow, where is this going to take me? Where do I get to go with this from here? It looks a little daunting, but I'm going to take a deep breath. I'm going to step back. I'm going to feel my way into this, and I'm going to allow this challenge to uplift me, however that's going to happen. And it's not a bunch of words. It may be initially, it's a kind of a fake it till you make it. But once you get there and you recognize it and you start to see in your life on an everyday occurrence how things unfold for you to support you, I've had some of the most extraordinary experiences in the last couple of days. A friend from San Diego, who we used to get together with every week, him and his wife, pretty much we would do happy hours, and you know, we didn't really part ways. I mean, we're still friends. We just sort of, things shifted and changed, and over time toward the end, we weren't seeing as much of each other, but we were still very fond of each other and still enjoy each other. And, why am I telling you this story? I hate when that happens, when it just goes away right in the middle. God. Please refresh my memory. Why I started there. What was I saying?
You were talking about the two ways of looking at a challenge. One.
Oh, the magical things that happened. So, yesterday morning, I woke up, I saw something on Facebook that reminded me of him. And I thought to myself, I need to be in touch with him, because he was recently diagnosed with cancer and has been going through some really intensive treatments. And I thought, I really need to reach out to him. And it was a very intensive kind of, I really want to reach out and say hi and see how he's doing, and you know, touch base one-on-one as opposed to on Facebook. And then I was out working and driving, and I was coming up the road to my house, and I thought about it again. And I said, oh good, that's right, I wanted to talk to Greg. 2 minutes later, I was pulling up into my street and Greg texted me. Greg has not texted me for any reason I couldn't even tell you when the last time was. And at least since we've lived there, for sure. So it was just really striking and remarkable to me that I could have just a positive thought about and it would show up in my world like that fast, like there. And the point of it is the difference in perspective, that while I may be personally going through whatever I go through, there's a difference in how I approach what that is, which is, it doesn't mean that my mind doesn't still want to beat me up, and it doesn't mean that my mind doesn't still tell me a lot of stuff that's just crap and garbage. But because I know that, now I can go to the other side and stop and go, take a step back. Where am I at? Yeah, the noise is going on over here, But I know that my destination is really clear. I know that I'm taking those steps. So whatever this is in front of me is part of getting me there. Don't know how yet, but I'm willing to go there. And the reason that I choose that is because it feels better. In the end, it feels better. I can still have challenges and I can still have those things go on, but I don't have to suffer through them. I don't have to go into this abject misery to get through it. And it doesn't mean that I don't have moments that I'm not miserable for a little bit. But again,
right,
as soon as I recognize it, I have to stop and say, reality check, dude, what's your destination? Is your destination that you're going to die tomorrow? Or is your destination that you're going to move on to more evolution and growth or whatever? And I'm sort of broad stroking it, but on purpose, but to demonstrate that it's ultimately always a choice of where you put your attention. And so the challenges become more enthusiastic. You don't always like them, but you can have fun with them, which is a little different, and a whole lot different than a lot of people go through when they have challenges, because they want to go immediately to suffering. And that doesn't serve. You're still going to get there from here. It's just going to be a lot slower and a lot more miserable. So hopefully that helps the listener.
Yeah, I like where we've arrived, where this helps me understand why the word suffering in the Buddhist context never really fit for me. Mm. Why challenge just works so much better. And I ask people that I work with that are wanting to operate less in a judgmental mindset of things that are happening in their life, to stop calling them good and bad and referring them to be seen more as easy or simple versus very challenging. So we have hard days and we have easy days, and not one is not better than the other. As a matter of fact, I'm a firm believer it's in the more difficult ones that we learn the most from. And I'm willing to be wrong on that. That's just been my experience.
Well, no, I agree with you. And I think it stimulates us in a way. It stimulates us into more momentum. It stimulates us into more forward motion, because in those challenge times, you're getting to really define what's important. You get to define what you like, what you don't like, what feels good, what doesn't feel good. You know, and that's what the whole game is to me, is really getting to that place where you can have some fun in that exploration and recognize that, you know, because we don't understand necessarily the depth of all the stuff that we take on in our human experience, and whether that's tied to lots of past life energies or, you know, I mean, in a lot of, at least in my understanding, you know, we have this being that's here is animated by that spark of that higher self, of that larger experience of who we are. And that makes a difference to me. It doesn't mean you have to believe in God or Jesus or Buddha or anybody. It's about recognizing your own, you know, your own sacredness or your own divinity or your own godlikeness, however you choose to do it. There's no wrong way to identify, as long as you're identifying in a way that is helping you in that forward momentum.
I think somebody wrote a song that had the lyrics in it, "Your Own Personal Jesus." Probably. Depeche Mode, maybe.
Yeah. Be something to look up. We are, I think we wrote about that place in our podcast, Sir Jeff.
Yeah. One last comment I'd like to offer regarding the experiences we go through that one might say are easy or flow versus those that are really challenging. Looking at it neurochemically or even through like a brain imaging scan sort of thing, where you could see live in the moment. When there's a challenge in front of us, we have more of the brain that's active. Therefore, there's going to be a sense of feeling more alive, more on, than when we're in flow or we're in chill. So learning, because you're just hitting more parts of the brain, it's happening at more levels, seems to be more complete and last longer when there's a challenge than when it comes really easily.
That's a good point. I remember when I was young, I think it was before I left home. So it had to be 13, 14 years old. My brother and I got into a fight about something or whatever. And my dad came to talk with us. And the conversation was largely about, and it's funny because I still remember this to this day. The conversation was largely about, we lived a very comfortable, what I would consider upper middle class growing up. I mean, my dad had his own business. We did well, you know, we had everything we needed. It was a good growing up period. But the thing that he said was, he felt bad for us because he knew what we were going to have to encounter in the way of challenges to be able to go from nothing to maintain what we're used to once we don't have it anymore.
Right.
And, I remember that conversation so vividly because I thought, what a horrible thing to say at the time as a kid, you know, thinking, whatever, you know, and realizing as an adult how powerful that was, because it really demonstrates that whole idea that, you know, the challenges are built in and your environment is there to help that evolution. You know, you were talking about ease and flow and I think it's always supposed to be about ease and flow, but I also know that ease and flow includes challenge, because it doesn't mean I'm ease and flow. It doesn't mean I'm not in ease and flow. It just means that I'm challenged within it right now. But that's, again, that takes us back to the perspective. Where do you put your focus? Where do you put your focus?
Absolutely.
Well, this is a great topic. And we could probably, like all of them, we can go more and deeper and further, and that's the joy of being able to do this podcast.
I agree. It's fun. Good stuff.
No limit. There's no same mountain. They're all different. And so today we were talking about the concepts of struggle and challenge, and we did not get much into the acceptance piece.
We didn't. We'll have to do that again.
Yeah, we'll have to do, maybe we do acceptances the next one. But yeah, we spent a lot of time with understanding the struggle, but I think that's really important. It's a place where I think a lot of people get tripped up on their path, is thinking that it's going to get easier. And it does, but it's not easy in the way you think of. It's not, you know, it gets simpler, but not in a basic sense. It gets clearer. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Well, I was just thinking about a path, and I guess the path, is at the base of the mountain? Is it, you know, the vertical part near the top? Is it on the back side of the mountain? And how many times you've been on that mountain? So there's a lot of interesting ways of looking at that, but being on the path and walking is definitely better than not being on the path and not walking. which I'm afraid most people, a lot of people have gotten off the path and they aren't walking anymore. They're sitting in front of televisions and they're watching other people walk their paths or journeys, and they're self-medicating themselves in some way and not getting very far down their paths. But hope that doesn't sound judgmental. That's just meant to be an observation.
All good stuff. Well, it's been great sharing time with you again, my friend.
You too, really, Jim.
Enjoyed the conversation and looking forward to the next one.
Right on.
To all you out there in podcast land, thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Adventures in Truth podcast. If you would like to listen to more or to explore all our offerings, visit us on the web at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com. We also offer video versions of our podcast. Visit our page on YouTube at Adventures in Truth Podcast. We would love to hear from you. like, connect, and follow with us on Facebook. Want to book us for your next podcast or to speak at your event? Head over to our webpage at www.adventuresintruthpodcast.com at the bottom of the page and send us a note. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to seeing you again at Adventures in Truth Podcast.